disciples questioned him. They said to him, "Do you want us to fast? And how should we pray and give alms? And what diet should we observe?" Jesus gave two responses. First, Jesus said, "Do not lie, and do not do what you hate. For everything is disclosed in view of your actions. And there is nothing hidden that will not become revealed, and there is nothing covered that will remain undisclosed." And second, he replied to them, "If you fast, you will bring forth sin for yourselves, and if you pray, you will be condemned, and if you give alms, you will do harm to your spirits. And if you go into any land and wander from place to place, if they take you in, eat what they will set before you, heal the sick among them. For what goes into your mouth will not defile you, rather what comes out of your mouth will defile you." Welcome, friends. As we're in Lent, I thought these sayings from the Gospel of Thomas about fasting would be both instructive and challenging, so potentially enlightening for us. Here, Jesus categorically states that what you say is more important than what you eat in terms of how you might injure yourself, how you might defile yourself. So you might ask, do you do yourself more harm with your tongue than with what you consume, your food? James, in this week's reading from the Epistle General, says, "For the unbridled tongue is an unruly evil and full of deadly poison. How little a member to boast such great things, how great a blaze such a little fire kindles." Meaning, your little tongue can do great damage when allowed to just voice whatever it occurs to you to voice without giving careful consideration to your speech. And he goes on to imply that no one should be claiming to be a follower of Christ who speaks ill of others. Further admonitions follow in the Gospel, which is from Luke 6, where Jesus says, "You see the splinter that is in your brother's eye, but you do not see the beam that is in your own eye. When you remove the beam from your eye, then you will clearly see to remove the splinter from your brother's eye." And actually, this is the version from the Gospel of Thomas, but a similar one is found in Luke 6. And it is really the main thing this whole talk on control of speech is all about. And that reminds me of a time I was once traveling by bus to UWA when I was a student there. We had two buses to catch, a bus into Perth and a bus from Perth to uni. The second bus always got really full first thing in the morning, so there wasn't a lot of space by the time it properly left Perth. I usually got a seat because I got on at the terminus, the bus port. Still, it would fill up a lot. Speaking of filling up, before I get onto that, you know, I had three teachers of Tai Chi Chuan. My first teacher knew everything about Chen style Tai Chi Chuan. Its history, the moves of the form, all the concepts like silk reeling, and he could talk and talk and talk. He had so much knowledge about every facet of every move. And when I asked him about the internal nature of Tai Chi Chuan, he had answers for that too. And they all made sense, you know, transferring forces from here to there, from point to point and around this axis or that circle. And, you know, I thought Tai Chi would have something to do with Qi, you know, Tai Chi, Qi. But he said the Qi in Tai Chi was not Qi. Tai Chi, the word anyway, had nothing to do with Qi. And it turned out he was right about this too. Tai Chi is just the yin-yang concept. Strictly speaking, it means great ultimate. The yin-yang symbol is actually called the Tai Chi Tu. So anyway, I did ask him once about Qi, but for him there was no Qi, or at least if there was, it wasn't important. He was certain that Chen Tai Chi Chuan was an internal martial art, but she, as far as he was concerned, was for illiterate farmers. So my second teacher came along when my first teacher decided to go to China to improve his martial arts. Because yes, my first teacher knew all this stuff and his form looked beautifully gymnastic and powerful, but he kept being beaten in push hands. Chen style push hands is almost like a kind of wrestling. Looks very much like wrestling. One of the people who consistently beat him was my second teacher. My second teacher was a young and quite small but very solid Chinese guy and had been quite successful in these push hands competitions. He didn't know much history or lots of intellectual concepts, but he could often take another person to the floor, other people to the floor in a matter of moments. Somewhere around the changeover between teachers, the grandmaster had come over from Canada. And while at a workshop with him, the grandmaster, had told me I wasn't connected and sort of dismissed me just like that. It was a bit of a blow. So I got very keen to learn how to be connected. If the master wasn't even willing to help me, I would redouble my efforts. So I started relearning my form from my new teacher because it turned out the version of the form that my first teacher had taught me was a bit different in certain ways. And speaking of connecting, the new teacher was a challenge. I mean, he was much younger than me and he didn't say very much, didn't talk much compared to my first teacher. My pushing gradually improved with him, as did my form, my poise and stances, but still, even though I pushed a bit better and developed my form to be more precise, faster, more athletic, I still couldn't make myself connected, whatever that meant. And this brings me to the next part of Luke, because it's all about, believe it or not, connection. Luke 6. Grapes are not harvested from thorns, nor are figs picked from thistles, for they do not produce fruit. A good person brings forth good from his treasure. A bad person brings forth evil from the bad treasure that is in his heart. And he speaks evil. For out of the abundance of his heart, he brings it forth. So the fruit and the tree are connected because the fruit and the tree are all one process. You can't love the fruit and hate the tree or love the tree and hate the fruit. And Jesus says that too. If the fruit is our speech, what is the tree? Speech is controlled by the quality of the perceptions of the speaker. I think we can all safely say that. Speech is controlled by the quality of our perceptions. So the tree is the field of perceptions, the field of awareness. Then, if speech is the fruit of the tree and the tree is the field of awareness, if your awareness is clear and empty, limpid and still, your thoughts will bring no turmoil and your perceptions will be true. If your awareness is filled with content already, like the beams in your eye from the previous little parable, you have no hope of seeing or experiencing what is really there and no hope of having good thoughts, since your thoughts have already been corrupted by the content. Further, no hope of control of speech and no hope of intelligent action. And for most of us, most of the time, we are not limpid and still. There are beams in our eyes. To control speech, one's field of awareness must be limpid and still. How to bring about a field of awareness that is clear and still in this world of difficulties and challenges and problems? Not an easy thing, because we are talking about being in a state of absorption or emptiness, in a word, meditation. Can we really be in a state of meditation 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year? Because, you know, I was telling you about being on that bus to UWA. And back in those days, I spent a lot of my free time learning to meditate. See, it's all connected. Not because I was on a bus, but I had a lot of time to do this because my best friend was always, always late. I think I may have told you about this in another talk. We would arrange to meet, say, in the evening around 8 p.m. in the hills overlooking Perth because we both lived up there, and he would be late. And we would arrange to meet, say, having lunch in the city, and he would be late. Or we would arrange to have go to a movie or have a coffee or go have a drink. And each and every time, he would be late. And I remember one time sitting on a bench in the Hay Street Mall under a not very shady tree and waiting for him in half lotus for 2 hours. I didn't think anything of sitting in half lotus for 2 hours back then. Couldn't do that now. But then it was just what I did. And because that's what I did, I had a lot of time between something happening on the outside and my response to it on the inside. And I would find myself absorbed in the lightness of having no head. It's not nirvana or anything, just your classic sort of witnessing, which opens neither the void nor the non-void. And I had long given up getting annoyed with my friend. He was just how he was. It used to annoy people around me, though. Girlfriends. I went through a few of those. All pretty much thought me crazy for being friends with him, but I didn't mind. It was a good opportunity for me to learn how to become tranquil, stable, how to chill my internal states. And it generally meant that when he did finally show up, nothing would faze me. I was super tranquil, super serene about things. And this had some advantages because I got so practiced at this tranquility that I was absorbed into it a lot. So I can tell you it is possible to maintain the meditation state, the meditative state, the samadhi state, if you like, for a very long time. But a desire arises to share this state with others and it is incommunicable. So to function in the world in the end, I gave it up. I'm sure some of you have experienced something similar in your lives. If you haven't, you must try it. Samadhi is great. And you are changed by it forever. But it isn't enough. Since it is not possible to always remain in a perfectly still, clear state all the time and get along with people, and because it is so easy to be caught up in the endless and unnecessary rules of the world, which, we need something that's a little bit easier, really. And so something like stability or equanimity is what we're going for. And here's the thing. We get so caught up in these endless and frankly unnecessary rules of the world, mostly through the mechanism of speech, of the tongue, and its imbalancing effect. Speech, especially contentious speech, often arises purely from the mind not being at rest. And so I'm going to steal from the parallel tradition of Zen because I found that their method for dealing with the stuff of the mind is incredibly powerful, even for a Christian aspirant. Zen master Hakuin was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. A beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived near him. Suddenly, without any warning, her parents discovered she was with child. This made her parents angry. She would not confess who the man was. But after much harassment, she at last named Hakuin. In great anger, the parents went to the master. Is that so? was all he would say. After the child was born, it was brought to Hakuin. By this time, he had lost his reputation, which didn't trouble him, but he took very good care of the child. He obtained milk from his neighbours and everything else the little one needed. Actually, this goes to how this kind of equanimity is achieved, since that itself isn't easy. Mumon recounts a story in his collection called The Gateless Gate. The wind was flapping a temple flag. Two monks were arguing about it. One said the flag was moving. The other said the wind was moving. Arguing back and forth, they could come to no agreement. The sixth patriarch said, "It is neither the wind nor the flag that is moving. It is your mind that is moving." The two monks were struck with awe. But Mumon comments, "It is neither the wind nor the flag nor the mind that is moving. Where do you see the heart of the patriarch? If you can see clearly, you will know that the two monks obtained gold intending to buy iron. Also, you will know that the patriarch could not repress his compassion and made an awkward scene. The wind moves, the flag moves, the mind moves. All of them missed it. Though he knows how to open his mouth, he does not see he was caught by words." Reminds me of that old fable of the sun and the wind. And I don't know if you know it, because the wind believed he was stronger than the sun, and the sun believed he was stronger than the wind. Friends though they were, each was determined to prove he was the stronger. And one day, the wind saw a man walking down the road and said to the sun, I wager I'll prove I am stronger than you. Watch me blow his coat off." And sun said, "I will take your wager and let's see who gets his coat off him first." So wind said, "Good, I will get his coat off first." So he blew and the man's coat flapped open in the wind. Seeing his success, the wind blew harder and harder and the man began to wrap his coat tighter and tighter. So wind blew even harder and even succeeded in blowing so hard a couple of buttons popped off. But that just made the man double over into the wind even more and pull his coat closer. Wind had to stop for a rest. Exhausted from all the heaving he had done, he was now quite out of breath. And so Sun said, "It must be my turn." And Jesus said, "If you do not fast from the world, you will not find the kingdom. If you do not observe Shabbat as Shabbat, you will not see the Father. Because if you want to be free, fasting from the world is a necessity. Being a passerby is a necessity. Being not of this world is a necessity. To be untouched by the cares of the world is both difficult and powerful. It makes you dangerous. It makes you capable of intelligent action. It makes you capable of great kindness. It makes you free, especially free to speak and act as you wish, without doing harm." But as I was saying, the sun said, "It must be my turn." And so he turned his warm glow on the man. And the man started unbuttoning his buttons, and still the sun shone warmer and brighter. Eventually, the man began to sweat. Then, much to the wind's chagrin, he actually pulled his arms out of the sleeves and took the coat off completely, laying it down by his side. The wind scowled in dismay, but the sun beamed with happiness and turned to the wind saying, "It seems I win. I am stronger." Wind frowned and said, "But that's not what I meant. You did nothing to get the coat off of him yourself. He did it all." Sun simply said, "Yes." This is the kind of skillful means we can use on ourselves when we go for something easier than the perpetual meditative state, when we go for stability or equanimity. If we can remain stable no matter what happens to us, we can get a lot more done than going for perpetual samadhi. And we should probably remove all those beams in our own eyes for good measure, but gradually, and as a group, as a humanity. Otherwise, you'll find yourself alone on the mountaintop, experiencing bliss, with no one to share it. Only fun for a while. But back to Hakuin, because a year later, the girl mother could stand it no longer. She told her parents the truth, that the real father of the child was a young man who worked in the fish market. And the mother and father of the girl at once went to Hakuin to ask his forgiveness, to apologize at length, and to get the year-old baby back again. Hakuin, of course, was willing. In yielding the baby, all he said was, "Is that so?" So obviously, I like sin. But it really is this kind of stability in the face of the slings and arrows of the world, which can be thrown at you by the world, that you need. We need this kind of equanimity in order to be unchained. And so control of speech is not done just by clear, still awareness. One must also develop a technology of speech which allows you to evoke the experience in others. Poetry is such a technology. But if you can't spend all day, but it's not just if you can't, but you can't. You can't spend all day every day speaking in poetry. You never get anything done. So this is how ceremonies and rituals come into existence, for sharing in something that cannot be conveyed in normal speech. And we all share in it to the extent that we can. It's also why those Zen stories come into existence. Holy Eucharist controls our speech for the little while we are in it and allows us to share in something its originator created to give to us something he could not otherwise. If we move through the one life recognizing its perfection with just enough humility to acknowledge the infancy of our own perceptions of that life, becoming as little children, then good fruit must come from our lips, and recognizable compassion is the inevitable effect of knowledge of our own infancy. The stable softness of love follows naturally when one dwells for any length of time in compassion, and happiness is right there with it, in the stable softness. The sixth patriarch, notwithstanding. So anyway, there I am on the bus going to UWA. I got on and I rode toward uni, and this girl gets on just after me and sits down next to me. The bus was pretty full and she was as fulsome as she was pretty. So I started to talk to her, mostly just leading questions. "Hi, what's your name?" Well, it's not a leading question, but you know, like, "What are you studying?" And that kind of thing. But at a certain point, the world just seemed to go into slow motion. Like a stone, I fell straight to the bottom of the still pool and perceived every ripple in the water of consciousness. I found I could predict what she was going to do and say, and it was so easy to harmonize with her and just talk to her in a way that made her want to keep talking to me, which was of interest to me at the time. I didn't have to say much. I didn't have to think much. It was like a dance. It was really nice. Almost like reading her mind without a me to read her mind, without me getting in the way. That kind of thing was very easy for me back then. And it did come from me spending quite a lot of time in the samadhi state, absorbed in emptiness. Mostly it came from allowing what was just to be. Which reminds me that even though you might have remembered to forget this, I mustn't forget to remember to tell you about the third of my three Tai Chi teachers, because he is the most important and very different from the last two, the first two, with a very different philosophy, probably because, well, he teaches a different style, Yang style. I embraced Yang style because I realized that there were things I didn't like about the Chen style people, including their obvious connections to gangster-like stuff and to the Chinese government, which was looking increasingly like a hostile gang of criminals itself. And more, the Chen people displayed a lack of courtesy and ethics I thought teachers of a martial arts style should have. I saw some terrible things and heard boasting about even worse ones. So when suddenly I discovered someone who really did seem to have almost magical abilities when it came to pushing, sparring, self-defense, healing, whose students were really good and clearly always getting better, it was only natural to investigate it. Here was someone who could make people lose their footing just by them touching him, or in some cases not touching him at all. He really did look like a Kung Fu master. He was Australian too, even if he no longer lived here, so that was also good. It turned out he also knew what Qi was, and that meant implicitly he also knew what being connected was too. So I began my study with his method, his school, called Heaven, Man, Earth. I began to learn a little Negong, which means internal work, previously something only inner door students received in other styles that I was aware of, because all of the apparently magical stuff they could do depended on having done lots of Negong. And I don't know if you know what Negong is, you probably don't, but in this case, in the case the Negong I learned, it begins with something called sinking the qi and stretching the so-called white tissue, the connective tissue, the fascia. And it's a process with essentially three elements, ting, sung, and yi, which in my limited translation would be listening, release, and intention, respectively. In other words, you have to put your mind into each part of your body so you can ting, or listen, be aware of it, listen to it, and then command it, yi, to sung, or release, doing this over and over and over again in different ways. So while this is no secret sauce, just my simplistic summary of a few principles, it is the way you sink the qi. It is the way you develop a root, and it is the way you remove errors from your Tai Chi Chuan. You become connected. The more connected you are, the more you can feel the disconnection in others, and your ability to move them increases as well. All the time, the approach you begin with is the approach you continue with, is the approach you master the art with. You start as you mean to go on. The means and the end are one. The tree and the fruit are all one process, and the beginning and the end are one. Because above all, one begins to learn everything is already perfect, including us, even if paradoxically we cannot perceive that yet. God is a perfect God. Is it possible he could create an imperfect world? All imperfections are only imperfections in our own perceptions. Taken to its extreme, this teaching is love. So, to control speech, one must allow speech. To control self, one must allow self. By observation of speech and self, one comes to an end of stupidity, by suffering one's own stupidity to its end. One softens, releases, laughs maybe, and learns. One's field of awareness has grown, and one has become just that little bit closer to realizing the perfection of the Hidden One. So I'll finish with this from E. Cummings. In time of daffodils, who know, the goal of living is to grow, forgetting why, remember how. In time of lilacs, who proclaim, the aim of waking is to dream, remember so, forgetting seem. In time of roses, who amaze, our now and here with paradise, forgetting if, remember yes. In time of all sweet things beyond, whatever mind may comprehend, remember seek, forgetting find. And in a mystery to be, when time from time shall set us free, forgetting me, remember me. Thanks for listening.